Hello everybody, my name is Dave Crawford. I'm a user experience lead in the Windows Phone and Windows 8 Centers of Excellence in the UK at Microsoft. And I'm here today to talk to you about some Metro concepts for developers. So hopefully I'm going to try and give you some more concrete guidance to designing for Metro than you may have seen in other decks and presentations in the past. So today, we're going to talk about these topic areas. We're going to talk about how to plan the design of a Metro app, which controllers you should be using and when. We're going to talk at this point in specific reference to Windows Phone 7 here. We're going to talk about some design tips and tricks that you can use, some common design issues that we see through all the apps that come through into the marketplace, and how you can avoid those. We're also going to look at how you can brand an application experience based on your customer or partner's brand. And throughout all this, I'm going to be showing you a bunch of examples so you've got an idea of what to do and what not to do. So before we begin, a little disclaimer for you. I'm not trying to turn you guys into a designer. For a start, they're putting me out of a job, and I do quite like my job. But also, you guys are devs, and that's what you're best at. What I am trying to do, though, is give you more tips and tricks and more tools to your arsenal so that when it comes to designing and building out some Metro, you've got a little bit more to go when you're doing design work for that. So here's a little bit of an uncomfortable truth. Users will judge the quality of your app based on the design. In some cases, they'll see the design of your application before they even start using it or see the features. So it's important you start to get these things right up front. No matter how good your code is or how well developed it is, if the app looks bad, people are going to get a negative impression from the start. So before users even see your application running on their device, they're going to see it through the marketplace or through the store to some degree. In the marketplace and the store, they see it in search results. They also see it in the app detail screens, where you can see screenshots of the app before you install it to get an idea of what the app looks like. And if you've got two apps that have identical functionality, this makes a real difference to the user as to which app they're going to pick and download. So I'm going to show you a little example now in Windows Phone. These are all faked examples here. But throughout this talk, I'm going to be referring to an example called Contoso News application. This is a fake news station that we made up. They built an app which lets users view news articles and view latest stories and things like that. So imagine in my Windows Phone, I've gone to the marketplace and I've searched for news. These are some of the search results that I might get back. Okay, it's very basic here, only two results in our marketplace at the moment. But you can see already there's a very big difference between these two apps in terms of visual presentation. The top one there, Contoso News Channel, it looks corporate, it's got good branding, it ties back to the branding of our channel there. It looks like an official application. The one below it, our News Flash, apart from the name of the application, which probably isn't the best choice, the icon already doesn't look very appealing, doesn't look very stable. It's just got this clip art that's just been reused and slapped together on a tile. So already when the user sees these search results, they're going to make a choice about which app they'll look at first. Let's say, for example, that my user is quite open to trying new things and decides to look at both of these two applications before deciding which one to install. The next thing they'll do after reading the feature set and maybe a couple of reviews is actually look at the screenshots on the marketplace. So here on this slide, I've got examples of the Contoso News application on the left-hand side. On the right, I've got some screenshots of the iNews Flash application. And you can see that if I was a user comparing these two apps against each other, one of them looks very well designed, very well considered. It's very neatly laid out. The other one kind of looks a bit slapdash. Things have just been slapped on the page, alignments all over the place. There's lots of boxes and lots of lines dividing content. For iNews Flash, they've made some poor choices around text contrast, as you can see from the title at the top of the screen. They've also just kind of slapped this clip art just into the bottom corner as their form of branding. Unfortunately, it doesn't really work with the stark contrast between the white and the black. And on the list designs on the far right, you can see they've got kind of boxes all over the place. It's quite hard to follow. So this is what users are going to be using to judge whether they install your application or not, as well as features. Especially if you're looking at a relatively crowded market, such as newsreaders, for example, they will use these things to help differentiate between the apps and decide which one to download. But design affects more than just whether the user will download your app or not. It'll also affect the usability of your app, how easy people can actually get to and use the features that you've spent so long developing. It'll affect the ratings and comments of the application. You'd be surprised how many comments in the marketplace are to do with poor use of Metro or poor app design, and people are asking for a refresh to these designs. It'll also affect the repeated use of your app. If it's not very pleasant to use or very pleasant to look at, people aren't really going to keep coming back to it. So there's three things that I ask of you when you're thinking about designing for platform, and that is to respect the user, to respect the platform, and respect the brand. It's important that you respect the user's choice of Windows 8 or Windows Phone or whichever other Metro platform you're designing for. They've chosen that for a reason. They expect apps to kind of fit into the ecosystem. It's important that you respect the features of the platform so that you leverage the right constructs, the right navigation models, and the right interaction types. And finally, it's important to respect the brand that you're trying to surface on this. If you're designing a news application for a specific brand or whatever application it may be, try and bring through elements of that brand to the application so that it feels like it's part of that brand. So the next thing you need to start doing is actually planning your application. So I've got seven things here that I'd like to think about. First of all, think about what your app's actually going to do. And this may seem like a really stupid thing to say up front, but literally just mark down on paper the features that you expect your application to have. This helps make sure that you hit all of those feature points when you're implementing, that you don't leave anything out accidentally. And it also helps you to understand the full scope of your application. Think about who it's for. So tailor your application to the people who are actually going to use it. Is it going to be used by a particular segment of your market, or is it going to be used by the whole population in general? And think about how you're going to have to design for those specific audiences. For example, kids playing some kind of educational game will have very different needs to adults looking for news. You think about how it fits in. So look at apps that are already in the marketplace. This is a great place to look for competitive analysis and feedback. If you're planning a news application, search and download some of the other news applications out there and read the reviews. It's a great place to figure out what's good to do, what people are doing wrong, how you can improve, how you can be the best app out there. You think about where and when it's going to be used as well. Is it something that the user is going to be able to use in any place, whether they've got internet connectivity or not? Is it something that's going to work for them while they're in the tube or on the plane and they don't have any signal? You think about those considerations when you're designing an app. You think about the kind of content you're going to display. This is less of a concern for Windows Phone, as it's quite easy to switch orientation around, but you need to think about it for the Slate, where it might be a bit more cumbersome, or you might be working on a landscape display on a desktop rather than a portrait. Think how you can use the hardware. So for Windows 8 and Windows Phone, there's a base chassis specification. For the phone, you can guarantee to have things like an 800 by 480 pixel screen. There's going to be Bluetooth. There's going to be an accelerometer. See if you can use any of those things in your application to help tie it to the device and make it a bit more personal. And finally, think how you can use unique features of the operating system itself. So in Windows 8, we have the charms. You can be a shared target or a shared provider, which is great for hooking into other applications. On the phone, you can use things like the panorama and pivot controls. And these are things that really ground your application well on the platform. One thing we recommend to people to do is when they first sit down to design an app or plan an app, is to fill in this statement here. So imagine that you are designing an application and you have like a one sentence to describe what your application is really great at. We do that by using this best statement. So literally just complete this sentence. So the app is the best in this category at. In the case of our Contoso news channel, this app is the best in its category at keeping users up to date with the latest news. It's that simple. But this statement here that we've just created is going to be used as a referral point whenever we are designing pieces for application, whenever we're thinking of features, or whenever we're thinking of user goals. Everything that we do should support this statement. The next thing to do is to think of the user goals for the app. So it's important here not just to plan the features that you're going to develop, but also to plan the user goals. So this is putting it into more friendly terms about like the user will be able to do this, the user should be able to do this, rather than just saying it's going to have share, it's going to have search, it's going to have video playing capabilities. This is important to make sure you try and tie these features together into a more sensible user journey. So you can start by listing out all the things that your application will do and try and turn these into scenario-based things. So here we have an example of a user goals document. This is, again, for the Contoso News Channel case study. And all the examples I'm going to talk to you about with the Contoso News Channel case study are available to download, and I'll give you the link to that at the end of the deck. So here we have our overview, or our best start statement, which says it's an application that allows users to view the latest news, videos, and TV through the Contoso News Channel network. And then underneath that, we list five simple user goals. The user can browse and view the latest news articles. They can watch video clips. They can watch streaming live TV. They can share media and articles through Facebook and Twitter. And they can submit their own news reports along with photos to Contoso News. So, five simple goals of the application that the user has. And we're going to use these to help tie together our feature sets when we're building our information architecture model. Which brings us nicely into sketching the IA. So, as I mentioned, IA, information architecture, it's a term that we used, I guess it gained popularity when we first started designing websites. We used to plan out massive hierarchies of how you get from one page to another, almost like a family tree. And it helps do the same thing in Windows Phone and in Windows 8. Windows 8 has got two different kind of main architectures. One of them is the hub model, and one of them is the flat hierarchy model. Windows Phone just deals with the deep hierarchy. Here's an example of a navigation model in Windows Phone. It's very much a focused way of using an application. You're going through a hub in this case, and you drill down to some pages, and then when you go into a different part of the application, use the back button to come back up the stack and down to a different section of it. It's important here that there's no cross-jumping between the different sections. This is a model that you'll see in iOS and Android, where they have application tabs at the bottom of the page. It's great for kind of just hopping about the application. But we like people to design focused experiences that deal with specific topics at one time to help the user have a more rounded experience in the app. Now, there are five standard navigation models for Windows Phone. These are all documented in MSDN, so I'm not going to go into these in too much detail. Three of them are based around panorama and pivot controls, and the other two are the more simple kind of layouts you'll have around single pages or single lists. I'm going to briefly talk about the top three here. You'll see examples of these in the device itself as well. So the first thing I'm going to mention is the central application hub with panel areas. You can see an example of this on the device by calling it the people hub. And here you can see a panorama control. It has three different sections to it. One is a list of the recent contacts. One is a list of all contacts with some functionality around adding and searching for contacts. And finally, we have the What's New pane. So from here, I can drill into either specific contacts or I can drill into specific newsfeed items from these people. But this is literally the whole hub of the application. For most applications that we see coming through into the marketplace, they tend to use the panorama control with a menu, which can be seen here from this template. This is one of the templates that's available in Visual Studio as well. Here we have a slightly longer panorama. It's split into, again, five sections. We have a menu down one side, which lets the user drill into deeper areas of the application. And then we have four panes that showcase some featured items, some new things, and some spotlight items here. I'm going to talk a lot more about the do's and don'ts and the good and bad forms of panorama design later on in the presentation. I just wanted to give you a quick overview of the different types that we have. Next, we have the application tabs, or the pivot control, as it's also commonly known. This is a screenshot of Outlook, which is one of the native applications on the device. You can see here that it's basically like a tab control. It's almost like a Windows Phone version of a tab control. And you can see that this is a view of a mailbox. And the tabs, or the pivot pages, act as different filters of the inbox. So we have one for all messages, one for unread, and one for urgent. And these are just flicks between these to see the different types. This is a very common navigation model for apps where you want to get into content quickly or filter your view very easily. While we're talking about navigation models, it's important to talk about some of the hardware features of the device as well, in the case of Windows Phone. In Windows Phone, we have a hardware back button in the bottom left-hand corner of the device. As a result, this means that we don't like seeing these buttons inside applications. Cancel or close and back buttons. This is because all these actions are taken care of by the back button on the actual device itself, and it's what users will press to do that. As soon as you start dealing with close buttons or with your own back buttons, you have to start worrying about the back stack. And this is already taken care of for you by the device itself. One thing that we've seen people do is mess slightly with what the back button actually does. This is really going to confuse users. They expect back to always take them back a page. So, a little bit of advice here borrowed from one of my colleagues. Back means back. It doesn't mean forward, it doesn't mean sideways, up or down. It always means back. So please don't change what the back button does. Home buttons are a little bit trickier. If you look on the native experiences on the device, you'll not see a single home button anywhere on it. This is very important that you try and respect this when you're developing your own applications. Users aren't familiar with home buttons on the platform. If you put them into your application, you're going to have to then start managing the back stack yourself. People are going to be expecting different kinds of behavior from the back button than you might necessarily have coded for. and it gets into your whole world of pain. There are some small exceptions to using the home button in your application. And wherever possible, we try not to call it a home button, we call it something else. And a particular scenario that I can think of is a credit card payment process. So in this example here, from the start screen, the user's launched an application, they've seen a brief splash screen, and they're coming to a wish list. Imagine it's like your Amazon wish list, and they wish to buy an item from that. They tap the item, and then they go into this billing process here. So it takes them into several different screens where they can enter their billing details, their credit card information, delivery address, that kind of stuff. It takes them to a finish screen. Now from here, it makes sense to take the user back to the home page of the application, which is the wish list. So as pressing the back button would be a little bit strange. Once you've already finished your purchase, it wouldn't make sense to go back and review your payment details and review your billing details and all that kind of stuff. So from here, we would actually recommend people put like a continue shopping or back to wish list button, which actually takes the user back to the wish list at the beginning. I mentioned a few moments ago that I would explain in a bit more detail about pivots and panoramas, and this is where we're going to go into a bit more detail now. So these are two controls that are unique to the Windows Phone platform. We don't have them on Windows 8 as such. We've got something very similar to that. But for the form factor, we call these pivots and panoramas on the phone. This is an example of a panorama control for our Contoso News Channel case study. Panorama controls are best thought of as being like magazine covers for your application. They're designed to encourage exploration. They serve a few highlights. And they're not designed to have the entire content of your application or the entire list of contents of your application on the screen. Here we have a panorama divided into three content sections and one menu section. And the user can just pan sideways to flick between these different content areas. We've picked three things that we want to surface on this panorama control. We want to show off the latest stories, some of the latest videos, and surface the most popular news stories as well. So pick three themes, and we're showing them on the screen. We also have in the background an image, which is related to the most recent story, and we have some branding at the top of the page as well. So let's break this down a bit, and let's go into the magazine cover metaphor a bit more. So here we have Wired magazine, which is one of my favorite magazines, along with a personal hero of mine, James Dyson. And I'm going to compare this to our Contoso News Channel image that you see to the left, sorry, to the right. So thanks to the magic of Photoshop, I can pull off a lot of this content and strip it back to just the magazine cover here. So if we compare this to our case study over here, we can see that if we pull all the content off the magazine cover, we're left with just a logo and a background. And on the Contoso News Channel panorama over here, we do a very similar thing. We have a background. It's slightly whited out so that you can see the text in front of it. And we have the title across the top with the logo type. Very similar to the magazine there. Now we start laying content onto the magazine cover. We bring in our major headline, our hero piece. It's interesting to note that the headline here is related to the background. It's a picture of James Dyson, and the headline's about James Dyson. If the headline's about James Dyson, you had a picture of David Beckham on the back, it would be a little bit confusing. And we do the same thing with the panorama control. Our latest story here is a story about China, so we have an image related to a particular news story. And in the background of the panorama, we also have a picture of China as well, to kind of tie those two things together. If the news story changes, we'd use a different picture in the background. Underneath here, on the magazine cover, you can see we have some sub-content related to the headline. Again, on the main panorama here, underneath the latest news story, we have some breaking news stories. It's related to the latest news section that we're currently in. Next, we start to add our secondary content or our other featured content. So in Wired, we add a link to the... Sorry, it's not a link on a magazine. We add a headline for the 2012 gear wish list. And on the panorama control, we add a section for the video. So it's not the primary content of the panorama, but it's still important enough to surface it on the front. And from there, we then add our tertiary content. In this, we've added our most popular section to the panorama control. We've also added a menu. It's almost like the way to navigate through your application. So in a nutshell, panoramas are designed to show highlights, designed to be immersive, and they're supposed to show up to three themes on them. Finally, there's something that you really need to consider is that a panorama should have a maximum of five panes to it. This is mainly for performance reasons. If you have more than five, things start to get really jerky and really laggy as the user navigates between them. But also because any more than five panes, and the user starts to get lost in the application. So this just helps to make sure that it's a very succinct experience for them. Pivot controls, on the other hand, are designed to show related content, designed to show much greater level of detail, and they're supposed to be efficient and focused to a particular task. So I've got a couple of examples of pivot controls. The first one is one I showed you earlier, which is from Outlook, and these are all different views of the inbox. So our parent object is the inbox, and our children are email messages, and it's all different views of those email messages. Now, this is a very simple way of using a pivot control. We also, in the device, have slightly more complex pivot control, which can be found in the People Hub. If you were to tap on a contact, you get this pivot appearing. So this is for a fictional person we call Sandra Foster. And the pivot items that we have in this pivot control are the profile, which lists all the different ways of contacting Sandra, when her birthday is, what her address is, that kind of stuff. If you swipe sideways, you then get to the What's New pane, which shows what's happening in the social networks that she's a member of. If you swipe sideways again, you'll see pictures of Sandra or pictures she's uploaded. And finally, in the history, you'll see all the recent conversation or call history you've been having with this particular user. So these are all very different content types, very different data types, and we'll be using very different data templates as well when you come to implement them. However, they're all things related to the Sandra Foster entity. So she's the parent object there, and these are all properties of her. So that's another way of using a pivot control, is it's kind of like different views of the parent object. When designing pivot controls, it's important to consider the length of them. Just like with the panorama, your controls will start to suffer, so your performance will start to suffer if you have too many items on it. So here's an example, a genericized example, that we saw from an application that was coming through our process. They were using a pivot control to surface the search results, which is a little bit crazy, because we ended up with a pivot control which literally had 48 items on it, and that's just if you narrowed your search down. If you didn't, you could have thousands. And if you imagine a user swiping through all these search results, it would not be the best experience in the world for them. But also, performance would take a massive hit. The time it would take to swipe between these things would be ridiculous. So we recommend that you limit your pivot control to 5 panes if it's non-sequential data, maybe 5 or 6 at a push. If it's sequential data, you can go a little bit further. We recommend you limit around 7, but you can sometimes push it to 12. This is to cope with things like days of the week. You know that after Sunday, Monday is going to come around again. And you know with months of the year that after December, January is going to come around. Performance might take a little bit of a hit, but it's important here that we're also thinking of the user getting lost in the categories as well. With sequential data, it's much harder for them to get lost, although they might berate you a little bit for having to flick through the panorama so many times. For non-sequential data, such as categories you may have in a shopping experience, you may have electricals, home and garden, books, CDs, DVDs. If it's an arbitrary collection of different categories that are more than five or six, the user's going to get lost in there. They're not going to know what comes next, whether it's going to be electricals, whether it's going to be garden. So it's important to keep them relatively succinct. Something else we ask you to consider when you're designing pivot controls and panoramas is gesture competition. So both the panorama control and the pivot control take a sideways swipe gesture. Now this can be performed anywhere on the control, not just in the headline at the top or the text at the top. And this is a common problem that we see from people using these controls the first time, is they'll put things like toggle buttons or map controls or sliders onto the panorama pivot control as well. And this is problematic because if the user tries to swipe on one of those controls, the control will start to swipe and the page will start to swipe. So when they finish swiping, the page will have changed. They won't know if the thing that they were doing, for example, turning a toggle switch on or off, has actually gone on or off or not. So in these examples, we replace toggle switches with checkboxes, or think of another way of designing the page where you don't need to use a pivot control. With sliders, you can use combo boxes. And map controls, we recommend use a static map control, like a little snippet of it, like you see in Bing on the device. And then tap the map control to take the user into full screen map experience. Browser controls are a whole of the story, and I've got some more to talk about on that later on. When designing your pages, it's important to try and design each page to perform a specific task above all others. And we see a problem with people peppering the user interface, both in Windows Phone and in Windows 8, with what we call floating buttons. Buttons that would make more sense to sit in the application bar. Now, there's a very important reason that we put buttons in the application bar on Windows Phone, particularly for things like the logging experience. So if you look at this example here, I'm trying to log into Contoso News Channel. I'll type in the email address, and then I'll tap on password and type the password in. But now my keyboard is going to be covering the login button. So I'm going to have to dismiss the keyboard with either the back button or tapping on the page before I can actually tap the login button. And that's not a particularly nice experience. However, if we were to put the login button as a little check mark into our application bar here, when the keyboard appears, the keyboard will never cover the application bar, which means the user can type their email address in and their password and just tap the check button and log them straight in. No dismissing the keyboard with the back button, no tapping over the screen to get rid of it. It's a really simple way of doing it. Application bars themselves can contain a maximum of 4 circular buttons in them. These are for primary actions for the page, and these actions should affect the entire page. So don't put things in here that are contextual to selections, unless it's on a separate page. If the user pulls up the application bar by the little 3 dots in the bottom right-hand corner, they'll see a list of other actions they can perform. This is where we put our secondary actions, things that aren't the primary reason for using the page. So in the case of this Twitter app example here, my primary actions are reply, message, follow, and block. The things that I'm going to use less often, block and report spam or view on Twitter.com, I've downgraded those and put them in the secondary actions in the application bar menu. This means that the feature is still there to users, but they're not clamoring for space on the screen. A common dialogue we have with customers and partners is that users won't notice buttons that are placed in the application bar. Now, this isn't entirely true. From the very beginning, Windows Phone users are trained that this is where they should go for primary actions. From the very first experience of the device through to every native experience, all primary actions sit in an application bar. So that's where they're going to look for these controls, and they're just as discoverable there. So I've talked a lot now about different navigation methods, a couple of interaction things you need to consider when you're designing your application. Let's go back now to actually building our app. So once we've thought about all these different ways of interacting with the app and we've planned our features out, it's a good point now to actually start sketching. Now, this is something that I always recommend to developers to do, but it's one thing that they don't often do. Just pick up a sheet of paper and a pen and start jotting some ideas down. It's very non-committal, whereas if you crack open Visual Studio and you start designing some screens, you're more reluctant to throw that work away. The great thing about working with pen and paper is it's really quick. It doesn't matter if you throw it away. You can start again very easily. So here I've literally just started to sketch out some ideas for our Contoso News Channel case study. I've not noted down at the top of the page a couple of the features, a couple of the aspirational aspects of the application that I want to use. And I've started thinking about the kind of controls I want to work with. Am I going to use a panorama or a pivot control? How am I going to look at the branding? I've started to sketch out some of the main pages here, such as the article page and video page. Some of my first ideas around how the information architecture is going to be laid out, maybe what the buttons are going to be in the application bars as well. And this, once you've gone through several different iterations of this and just kind of thrown ideas around, we move to this process called wireframing. Now, many of you may already be familiar with the concept of wireframing, but for those of you who aren't, it's basically a way of planning your screens out either on paper or in something like Visio or something, which shows the basic layout of controls but doesn't worry about the branding or the visual treatment of the screens. It just shows you where you're going to place your controls and how you're going to put buttons and navigation in as well. I like to start working on paper, but you don't have to. So this is the Contoso News Channel. And I've started to think about some of the key screens here. So the panorama is going to be very important to me, so I've started to sketch that out, as is the article view page and the video player. I've even started to sketch out a little bit of the Contoso News Channel brand in the bottom corner to think about how I'm going to click that into it as well. But if you don't like working to this level of fidelity on paper, by all means, just do it in Visio or PowerPoint or something like that. The whole point here is to make sure that you really think about the layout of things so that when you come into implementing things, you're not just slapping controls on the page. So here I've started with, again, the most important screens that I'm going to be seeing in my application. At this stage, you need to start thinking carefully about custom controls and where you're going to use them. Wherever possible, try and use the native controls that ship with the device, but there may be times when you want to do something which isn't supported by these controls. The difficult thing is you really need to make these look and feel like they are native controls so that users know how to interact with them instinctively. So here on my video player, I need to have a stream quality selector. So I've created this this control which lets me flick between low, medium, and high quality. These are actually just restyled radio buttons, but it means that I've had to rebuild the video player to fit these controls in. So it's important here that I make it act like the real video player itself. So if I tap the video, then the bar at the bottom disappears. If I tap it again, then it appears. Think interactions that users would expect from a control like this. On the contact us pane, I want to be able to add photos to the news stories that I'm trying to report. So here I've put a custom control here where I can add a photo to the bottom of that report. Again, try and make it look like Metro, try and make it look like the look and feel of the other controls in the app, and more importantly, make it behave in a way that makes sense to people who've been using this application or this platform. From here, it's time to start joining your key screens together or building sequences. So if I go back to my sketched out wireframes, I've got the main panorama and the article page, but in order to get from the main panorama to the article from, say, a list of all the news, I need to have a pivot control, so I've designed a pivot control there to sit between them. In Visio, that looks like this. I've got those three screens I showed you earlier, but in the middle here, I've got a pivot control. So when I tap on news, I go into the news pivot. When I tap on a story, I go into the article page. When I tap on the video, I go into video player. This is a great way of seeing how many taps it's going to take for the user to get through application. It's a great way of making sure you don't miss these intermediary screens as well. It's just as important to design these screens and think about the usability of them as it is for any of the major screens in your app. It's also a very important point to start thinking about the transitionary screens you may have in your app. These are screens which don't actually perform any particular functionality, but will have an impact on the user's experience of your application. So here we have a modal screen here, which just says, OK, hang on a minute, we're just going to send this to the news channel before you get back to your app. It's great, if ever possible, to make these non-modal, but sometimes there'll be cases when you can't do that. It's also a good point to design your splash screen and things like that. So now you have all these different sequences. We go back a slide. We have the sequence for getting from the panorama categories into a video player. We'll have other sequences that take us from the contact us to through the reporting your own news features. We'll also have things that take us into live TV. And once we have those, we can lay them all together on top of each other and come up with our full information architecture map. So here you can see at the top we have our main panorama control, we have the pivot that sits underneath it. It shows how we get from the contact us through the reporting stuff down the right-hand side there, all the way through to submitting your story and dealing with any error messages. This is now the entire application, and we've summed it up in, about 10 screens? But make sure that when we're developing this and designing it as well, that we can make sure we cover the entire set of screens we have here. Another common discussion that we have with partners and customers, more customers than partners, I would say, is that they want to have a consistent look and feel and experience across their apps on all the different devices. Now, with iOS and Android, which have fairly similar navigation structures, this may work, but with Windows Phone, it won't. It has very different interaction metaphors. It is a different platform, and it's got different navigation structures. And also, it's got a very different aesthetic to it, a very different look and feel. And so Windows Phone users are bought into this platform, and they expect to use the applications they're downloading to sit well with the other apps they have installed on their device and provide them with experiences served up in a way that they're used to seeing. It's very rare that users are going to have an Android, an iOS device, and a Windows Phone all lined up next to each other, all with your app installed, using it all at the same time, comparing the differences between them. They use this platform for a reason. Whatever that may be, and it's great if the apps that they're using fit in with the ecosystem that they have and don't stick out like a sore thumb that requires them to learn different ways of interacting with their own device. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground so far. We've planned our features, we've built our IA map now, and now we're going to look at some visual designs. Now again, I know you guys aren't designers, so I'm going to cover this relatively quickly, and we're going to talk about some tips and tricks here rather than some of the deep theory behind these things. Before we go any further, though, I'm going to briefly talk through the main principles of designing for Metro. These are particularly relevant to Windows Phone again. These are the five principles that the Design Studio derive Metro from. It needs to be clean, light, open, and fast. So this is, don't put too much content on a single page. Use white space to lay things out. Don't be afraid of blank spaces in your application either. It helps your content to breathe. Celebrate typography. We've got this beautiful font, at least from a designer's perspective, called Seago. And we use that throughout the device. It works well at both small sizes and large sizes, so it's great if you use that. Wherever possible, use motion. We have a set of standard transitions in the toolkit, which is the Silverlight toolkit for Windows Phone, which is downloadable from Coplex. We have a focus on content rather than Chrome. So Chrome is what we use to describe these, like the toolbar backgrounds or unnecessary bits of decoration that sit on the page. We want the user to be able to interact with content directly. If you think about something like the music and video experience on the device, if you want to play an album, you tap the album cover. There's no unnecessary play buttons to press. There's no fake 3D effects. You just tap the content and get straight to it. And finally, authentically digital. We know that this is a digital platform, and we respect that. Back in the days when people were moving from the real world, I guess, into the first graphical user interfaces, in order to let people know that a button was clickable, you used to have to put a fake 3D effect and a pressed effect on it to kind of mimic the real world buttons. Nowadays, if somebody sees a square with OK written on it, they're probably going to try and tap it. People are now more used to working in the digital world, and we like to stay authentic and true to that. So try and avoid things like drop shadows and bevels and gradients and things like that. They're not necessary in Windows Phone. And again, they'll stick out like a sore thumb. So here's some tips and tricks for you. This is an example of Swiss international typographic style. It's basically something that's come from print publications, which allow people to lay out content on pages in a way that's easy to follow and also aesthetically pleasing. And it's all based around a grid. Grids are made up of these large cells and these small gutters and columns that sit around them. And we do the same thing on Windows Phone and on Windows 8. This is the Windows Phone screen. It's 480 pixels wide and 800 tall, and we divided it into a number of rows and columns. And the great thing about this grid is it's very flexible in the layout styles. You can download this grid from Arturo's blog, and I'll give you a link to that at the end of the presentation. And it's very useful when you're in Visual Studio or in Blend to overlay this just as a semi-transparent PNG when you're laying out your content. It helps to make sure that you align things properly and you leave enough spacing. It wouldn't be very fair if I just preached this and didn't practice it, so we actually use this in the native experiences on the device as well. You see how everything here lines up to the grid. We respect the spacing between items to keep everything laid out nicely and consistently sized. The magic numbers, if you're laying out content, are 24, 12, and 6. So 24 is the distance from the edge of the screen to where your content begins. So it's the margins on the left and right of the page. 12 pixels that we use for spacing between items. So if we go back to the screen before here, you see that there's about 12 pixels between the different start tiles or between the recent contacts and the people hub. It's just a small number of spacing. And we use 6 for the space between text boxes or sometimes for padding within elements. While we're talking about laying content out, I should mention list design. On Windows Phone, you should use spacing rather than lines to distinguish between list items. Don't put backgrounds on them. When you're tapping an item, instead of filling the background color for feedback, users expect to see a tilt effect. And that is available in the Windows Phone toolkit as well. Please don't put list adorners onto your list items. List adorners are the little arrows you sometimes see on iOS or Android. Wherever users see a list in Windows Phone, they expect the items to be tappable and do something. So they will instinctively try and tap them anyway. So they don't need to see these extra ornamentation on them. Here are two different examples of list views as well. If you just have a thumbnail and one line of text, you should center align that. If you have multiple ones, you should align the text at the top of the thumbnail here. It's also worth noting on the screenshot on the right-hand side here that we used several different text sizes and text colors to give hierarchy to the information we're showing here. We're showing four different levels of content, which is quite a lot for a list item. But the way it's laid out is it's very easy for the user to scan. If everything was the same size and same color, it would be very hard for me to find an item in this list. But here, using a larger type size for the top piece of text on each list item, gives us something, a very obvious visual clue for the most important bit of information on this list. And we can scan through this list very quickly if we're trying to scroll through it. Please, please, please don't repurpose existing icons. These are the icons that ship with the SDK. There's not that many of them, but they all have very specific meanings on the device. We've seen a lot of people mispurposing the play button. When people see a play button, they expect it to play media, whether it's video or whether it's audio. We've seen play mean login, we've seen it mean next, we've seen it mean restart, all these different things. It's important that you keep the same metaphor so users don't have to relearn what it means. If you need an icon that doesn't exist, then either create one yourselves or find a friendly designer, or use a resource like the Noun Project. Just make sure you check your license first. I have a link to the Noun Project at the end of the presentation. It's a fantastic resource for Metro-style icons. Okay, the final section, and probably the meatiest section of the presentation now, is branding. It's a very difficult topic that we bring up with partners. When people first see Windows Phone, they think it's all very pared back and that they can't put any brand into it. But that's just the core experience on the device. You can actually create quite a rich branded experience within Metro without breaking it. But one rumor I need to quash first is Metro is not about boxes. It's all more about content and letting the content shine and be the primary way of navigating it. Above all, we want a partner's brand to shine on the platform. But we don't need to completely overpower the user and cover up the beauty of Metro and the ease of interaction with their device. This applies to Phone and to Windows 8. But again, I'm going to talk specifically about Windows Phone here. So some good and bad ways of branding a Windows Phone Metro application. A good way, if you've got a panorama control, use a background on that. It's great. It makes it more immersive. Just make sure it's relevant to the content in some way. If you can't tie a background to a piece of featured content on the panorama control, then use some branded elements to help do this instead. If you've got a logo, add that to the top of the panorama control, or even, in a smaller degree, to secondary pages in the top corner. If your brand has particular brand accent colors, for example, Facebook is known for using blue, use that as an accent color in your application instead of the user's accent colors. Bad ways of branding the experience are using a custom font throughout your application. You can use a custom font to certain degrees for titles and for headings on the display, particularly if it's very different to Seago. If you're using something like Arial, which is very similar to it, it'll look a little bit weird, almost a bit counterfeit. But that's a good place you can use them. Please use the standard Metro-style buttons instead of creating buttons with drop shadows and gradients and things like that. And as I mentioned earlier, don't use background colors and titles and list items and things. So I've got some examples now of some branded experiences. This is the Sky News website. You can see they've got a very strong brand coming through here. They love the kind of laser beam and the shine that appears in the background. They've got some very clear colors that they use. They like black and white and red and this very bright yellow at the bottom of the screen, which shows they're breaking news stories. If we look at their iPhone application, we can see that they've carried that brand through really well. But because the iPhone doesn't have this concept of panorama control, they've had to cram a lot of navigation and a lot of content onto one small space here, which means that a lot of the pages look very similar. If we look at the Windows Phone application, it just feels much more calmer. Yet, we're showing the same amount of content, we use the same branding elements, but it's just all spaced out a little bit nicer. So here in our main panorama control, we still keep Sky's brand across the top with their laser beam. We still keep their black, which is one of the main accent colors from the website. We use the yellow color for breaking news stories. But because we've got this panorama control, we can break out navigation and put that on one side. So we've got categories, video, your report, and discuss on one side, and we've got live TV on the other side. It makes for a much nicer experience when pacing through the panorama, and it's a much cleaner way of laying out the content as well. If we look at Foursquare, this is the Foursquare website. They love blue and orange and green as their accent colors. They also have these fantastic badges, which will work really well in Metro. This is the Foursquare panorama control. And here, they've really embraced Metro, but it still very much feels like a Foursquare application. Because they don't have imagery of every single place in the world where you might possibly be able to check in, they brought through some of their brand elements to the background of the panorama control. In this case, they brought back some of their badges that you can win in Foursquare, and they've lightened those out a little bit and put them in the background. So it still ties it to Foursquare really well and brings in some of their brand imagery, but it still sits in Metro very nicely as well. And they carry this through deeper into the application as well. You can see at the top, they've got a little Foursquare logo on some of the sub-pages to help brand the experience a bit more. They've also brought in some of their accent colors as well, these oranges and greens, to indicate when items are going to take you off the user's profiles or just to help show that things are tappable. And they brought their badges, which sit really well on the screen as well. So a really nice way of branding an application and still keeping it Metro. Next example I'm going to show you is jobsite.co.uk. So they recently refreshed their website. Here it is here. Again, from looking at this, you get a very strong sense that blue and orange and grey are their brand colours here. And they also have this font, this kind of narrow, high-type font. In this case, I think it's Franklin Gothic demi-condensed, I think. Very strong brand. Jobsite have released two versions of their application. The first one that they released had a very branded landing page, but then as soon as you left that, it got very, very plain, very kind of pareback Metro. And it's a shame here because they've got such a strong and beautiful brand, they can really carry this through into application. So we worked with Jobsite for a bit, and without changing the structure of the application, which is very sound, very well designed from a Metro perspective, we just applied the visual treatments and their brand elements to it. So here we brought in their light grey background. We brought in their custom font for across all the screens. So titles go in this Franklin Gothic. We even at the top of the page use it in the small caps at the top as well. We bring through orange, the accent colour for buttons. So we're still keeping a Metro button here. We're just filling it in orange. And we've also coloured the application bar in with their dark blue colour. So if you compare the two, there's a very obvious difference here. One of them feels much more like a job site app, and the other one feels less of a branded application experience. Another discussion that we have with partners and customers is that our brand is very important. We want it to shine through, we want it to really sit well on the platform. And we say that it can. You just have to pick the right place to show it. Some small changes to colors, to small brand elements, and some custom font usage, again, not across the entire app, can really help to brand an application, to make it feel more uniform with the rest of the experiences on different platforms. So it's a really important thing to consider. Finally, I've got three top tips for you. Firstly, please do not use browser controls in your applications. It provides a really poor experience for users. If you need to do something in Internet Explorer, then take the user out to Internet Explorer. They can get back into exactly where they left in your app just by pressing the back button once. Please don't provide branded experiences of IE. You end up just reducing the amount of space the user can actually use to interact with the content. They know it's a browser control, but they can't do things like work with their own back stack. They can't change the URL, anything like that. So it's not a very nice experience. The one exception to this is for quick authentication tasks, such as authenticating with Twitter or Facebook, where it's literally enter credentials and press submit, and then the experience is gone. It works quite well in there, and also for credit card payments if you want to use some kind of secure payment facility. When designing your app, your start tiles on the application start screen, please respect the layout of the user's screen and the kind of things they expect to see here. So try and avoid rounded corners, 3D elements, big gradients, things like that. On the screenshot on the right, you can see that it's very easy to actually land a strong brand here. We've got British Airways, they've used a dark blue background, but they've made it flat, and they've got their speed mark as well. Last FM is a fantastic example of a Metro-looking start tile. Foursquare have a very subtle gradient in there, but it's not enough to make it stand out too badly. It still sits very well from a design perspective. If there's one last ask, and one last thing I wanted to leave you with, it's about alignment. Probably about 90, maybe 95% of the apps that I see have got alignment issues of some sort or another. And it looks really bad. It gives a really negative impression of a brand, almost like you didn't care enough to lay it out properly. It's a really easy thing to fix. Either use a grid that I showed you earlier, or even just stick a post-it note to the screen and make sure everything lines up properly. Use the magic numbers, the 24, 12, and 6, to help out your content. It'll just make things feel a lot nicer. It's the kind of thing that people don't notice when it's right, but when it's wrong, really, really sticks out. And finally, when in doubt, for Windows Phone, the best guidance is on the device itself. If you're designing a settings experience, look at settings on the phone and see how that's implemented there. If designing pivot control, see how that's been implemented on the device. If you're designing a list item, go and look at all the different types of list item we have on the device. There are loads of different types of list item, and they should all provide you with inspiration for designing your own as well. So with that, I'll leave you with some resources. The first one up here is a set of documents that we provide to customers and partners. They contain the Contoso News case study that I showed you. We've got the user goals in there, the visual designs, and the information architecture map. We also have two more documents in here. One of them is called the UX bar document, and one of them is called the quality bar document. Now, the UX bar is a very succinct checklist for when you're designing, and it shows the good and bad ways of doing things and what you should be doing. So, for example, it will say, don't put these controls on a panorama control, put these on instead. So we recommend you use that almost like a checklist when you're starting to design and before you submit to the marketplace, just to make sure you've got the best experience possible. The quality bar talks about the kind of the tests you should be running before you submit your application to marketplace for performance and that kind of stuff. Create.msdn.com is the place to go for your Windows Phone design and development resources. There's a whole wealth of video content, of written content as well, that you can use. The NAMM project was that great website for icon inspiration. It grows every day. There's some fantastic icons in there, some very niche, some absolutely brilliant ones. Make sure you check your licenses before you use them, though. And finally, ux.r2.tv is a fantastic resource written by one of my colleagues in the Windows Phone product group in Redmond called Arturo Toledo. He's currently tasked himself with writing, I think, 30 blog posts by the end of the year on Windows Phone design, and they're very detailed and very, very good. It's also where you can download that design grid I showed you earlier. So with that, good luck designing your Windows Phone apps, and I look forward to seeing them.